Blog Talk Radio.
And now, broadcasting from the banks of the historic Vermilion River, amidst the rolling prairie, cornfields, and unsightly wind farms of central Illinois, it's the Rhino Hour of Power. With your host, Rick Moran. Like Diogenes without a lantern. And welcome, welcome, welcome all to the Rhino Hour of Power. I'm your host, Rick Moran, and joining me now from the left coast of the United States of America, my good friend, my buddy, the political professional from Oregon, Jeff Kropp. Jeff, how's it going?
Yeah, it is well, my friend. Great to be back with you and your audience again.
Yes, and considering that it took me about 6 weeks to get you to come back, I have to make an admission here, and I hope the audience isn't too offended, but in order to get Jeff Kropp back on my show, I had to profess my love for him. I had to tell him I love you. Of course, what man in America can resist me when I tell them I love them? So anyway, however it happened, I'm glad to have you back, buddy.
All right. Well, segueing into that, it's great to be with you, my friend, and lots of interesting things happening to talk about today. We have a great interview with Matt Lewis that you taped previously. You know, your entire premise on this show about vaccinations and why Republicans are afraid of science just
not
clearly illustrates why you're a rhino.
Well,
you're a rhino.
It's not all Republicans. I never said all Republicans. In fact, that most Republicans are for the mandate. Marco Rubio, Ben Carson, they're for the mandate.
I don't like it.
And
I'll tell you why. And for communicable diseases, yes. I mean, if you got the bubonic plague, you have leprosy. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I have no problems with that. But I've got a real problem if it's for the flu, if it's for something else. You know, I draw a line there, and I think that this infringes on constitutional rights of parents.
Well, I don't know about that. I just don't think it might not be necessary. Tetanus, for instance, is not a communicable disease. Tetanus is not airborne.
True.
So why risk side effects to a vaccine for your child if he's not going to catch it unless he steps on a rusty nail or something?
I completely agree with that.
It doesn't make any sense.
All right,
and that's a separate issue, though, Jeff. Jeff, that's a separate issue. But there are people who won't vaccinate their kids against measles or mumps or rubella, the MMR vaccine, despite the fact that any studies showing that there's a link to autism have been royally debunked several times over.
Yeah.
Anyway,
total fraud.
I
completely agree, but I got to share with you before we pop onto something else here. One of the most profound things about this that affected my life was in the mid-90s, when I went to Africa with World Vision in Senegal and Mauritania, specifically Mauritania, where just vaccinating the first five basic vaccines against the most basic childhood diseases, Rick, dramatically increased the survivability of those young children. You know, it's called 5x5, the first five vaccines in the first 5 years. And in talking to the parents and mothers of these kids who had survived, who had lost other children because they hadn't vaccinated them, I mean, I'm telling you, it is a profoundly positive thing. Are there, in fact, maybe some, you know, deleterious effects? Yeah, there might be. We'll wait to see in the long run, Rick, but I'm telling you, the evidence, the practical evidence of it far outweighs anything that one could surmise as being bad about it.
they are not 100% effective or 100% safe. We know this. But the risk of becoming seriously ill or dying from being vaccinated is far, far smaller than the risk of dying from measles or mumps or rubella or diphtheria or something else. So there are side issues, and you brought up a good one, that I think parents should have the opt-out option on things like tetanus and hepatitis B. Kids don't get hepatitis B. That's nonsense.
No, exactly. That's right. I know. So, I think rhino tonight as I thought you were.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that, buddy. It makes my day.
I've gone after you, so.
Yeah, I know. I didn't give you the opportunity this time. On the more serious subjects.
Yes.
More serious subjects, a very serious subject, ISIS, Islamic State.
Yeah.
ISIL.
I saw that today.
Whatever you want to call these people. And we got to decide on a name real quick because they're becoming
a
huge
problem. Let's just kill them.
That's a great idea.
You know, what they did to this Jordanian pilot, you know, which we know now happened a month ago, it's beyond description for how angry it made me. And part of that, Rick, I think, comes from my experience in combat operations in Iraq and Afghanistan and seeing the aftermath. Especially of the brutality of the Taliban in Afghanistan. And I'm telling you, I look at this, and I don't know how a human being can do that to another human being, but these are animals. And at this point, they are beyond reformation. And in my view, on the battlefield, you simply kill them without mercy. You wipe them out and exterminate, and you can. This group, you can wipe out and exterminate.
Let's hope we can. But I wanted to move on to a more general issue, and that is they are something we have never seen before. You call them animals.
Yes.
I suppose they are. Or are they clever, clever humans? Look, how many beheadings did we have? 5 or 6, right? People were getting kind of blasé about the beheadings. Islamic State beheaded another person. So what?
Right.
So they had to up the ante. They had to become even crueler. They had to become even more barbaric. So we're probably going to be treated now to 5 or 6 immolations. And then they'll try something else, maybe drawing and quartering. You know, maybe
how about
just
a chainsaw?
Dismembering people.
How about a chainsaw?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, all right,
absolutely.
So are the imaginations that they're coming up with to continue to shock the world, are they straight out of Hollywood? Horror movies?
This sure sounds like it. These are very sophisticated people. That's what makes them so incredibly dangerous. They have Western educated people in their cadres. These Western educated, they're not just don't have technical know how. I mean, firing off a rocket launcher or an RPG is one thing, but how about some of these TOW missiles that they've gotten a hold of in Syria? You just don't aim and fire and pull a trigger. You got to have some computer background. You got to know how to aim the damn thing. You got to know how to work it.
These
people are sophisticated, and the reason we're underestimating them at the moment is because of their barbarity, their cruelty, their 7th century mindset. The way they treat women and the way they, treat people.
And I think you've hit on something. I really do. I think this is deception on a massive scale, and I think you've hit the nail on the head. These people are sophisticated. If you look, I did not see the video, but I heard Shepard Smith on Fox describe it in detail because he had watched it. And there's no question that this was highly produced, highly sophisticated. That is as you have described it, and that is not only what makes them so dangerous, but it also creates the absolute imperative that we must destroy them because they are so sophisticated and they are so dangerous.
Well, consider how they move money around to finance themselves.
Yeah.
They got 30,000 fighters. They control an area the size of Belgium. They run an economy. They pay workers. They have all this sophisticated economic expertise going for them. When I say move money around, they are able to elude the best, you know, forensic money detectives in the world, and stash their cash in places that we can't find.
Are they really? Are they really, or is it that some of these best detectives in the world are simply either being purposefully misdirected or being bought off? I mean, I have a hard time to believe that if they're using any of the normal transmission methodologies that are available today in terms of moving money around, that they're able to achieve that successfully. The only way they could be doing it is the old method of where they literally take cash and they move it by hand, by person, from one person to the other. I just can't believe in this age of sophisticated banking that we can't track that. There's got to be a huge amount of corruption involved here if that's the case. And there probably are. I mean, look at the people who support them that we know have been supporting Al-Qaeda, supporting these Wahhabist schools that teach this hatred. You know, there's some very rich Saudis and Kuwaitis and Omanis and you name it that believe in this stuff and support them. And wouldn't they be very willing to continue this kind of instability? Doesn't it fit their purposes in the end? Sure it does.
Absolutely. And I'm sure, you know, Saudi Arabia is a grown-up country. I mean, they have, talk about sophisticated economics. I mean, you know, they're a world power in oil. So, you know, if you get just a couple of bankers in Saudi Arabia, either scared to death of these guys or, like you suggest, you know, ideologically attuned to them, then you're going to have a situation where they're going to help them. And they're going to help them move their money around and hide it. The way they get their financing, apparently, most of it is by selling oil on the spot market. Now, they're not getting much these days, and probably not being able to sell much on the spot market because there's a glut of oil. But having said that, when oil goes back up, and it's already going back up. So when oil goes back up to $75, $80 a gallon, they'll be back in business. And they'll be able to run their operation the way that they want, and it's not going to be a picnic getting rid of them. We can say we should kill them all. We should kill them all, but killing them all is going to be a problem.
Agreed. It's going to be a huge problem, and because they are smart and sophisticated, at some point, they will go underground. Look, even if we put, I have a friend who's, I work with a man. Let me say that the big army is seriously considering, I don't think it'll happen, but they're seriously telling some of their members that the fourth ID is going to go boots on the ground and they're going to go in and wipe those people out. Okay. I don't see that happening under Obama. To be honest with you, or John Kerry is our Secretary of State in our foreign policy, and I think no rational person would think that's possible. But that's what needs to happen. But even then, those people will go underground, and that's where having a visionary U.S. president put together a coalition of the Arab countries who are willing to stand against this type of thing and have a Middle East policy that makes sense, that isn't in complete disarray, so that you literally can stop this from occurring from country to country to country, a la Arab Spring. Until we have that, I don't see any solution to this. I don't.
Well, yeah, this is an Arab problem. It's got to be handled by the Arabs. And that means...
It's about damn time, don't you think?
Sure. Look at Jordan. Jordan is an absolute uproar tonight because their pilot was burned to death.
Yes.
And absolutely. Yes. If you were to ask the average Jordanian, should we send the Jordanian army in to take care of these guys? I bet you they'd have 70% of the people saying yes. And the same goes for, Egypt, which is in the crosshairs themselves with the attacks in Sinai. You get Egypt involved and Jordan involved. Jordan has a modern air force. Egypt has a modern army, so to speak, I mean, for the Arab world. Get those guys together. You get them to combine with the Iraqis, who might have by this time 150,000 pretty well trained troops. They're going to try to take back Mosul later this year, apparently. Whether they're up to that test, that urban type of warfare, that's another question. But
it is, yes.
They are going to be confronting Islamic State, the Arabs, and I don't think the American forces are needed unless Iraqi is defeated on the battlefield and Islamic State heads to Baghdad, you know. Then maybe we want to consider sending in the Marines or somebody, you know.
I respectfully disagree only in this sense. Yes, the Arabs should step up with their armies in a coordinated attack. That, of course, leaves Assad in power, but so be it. He's better than ISIS by any – as bad as the guy is and as much as we'd like to see him go. But we're going to have to bring air power at a higher level, because frankly the Arab countries have respectable air power. The Jordanian pilot burned alive. He talked about and described flying, hooking up with an air tanker, and getting refueled, and doing their bombing missions, those kinds of things. But at some point in time, we're going to have special forces on the ground working with Iraqi special forces, which I've seen and worked with. That's all I'll say about that.
Okay.
And are actually pretty darn good. And we're going to have those forward air controllers, and we're going to have B-52s out there destroying large swaths of land once we find their armies. And until that happens, until the Arabs step up to the plate and we give them the kind of air support they need, which means we put Americans in harm's way, and at some point in time, one of them is going to get shot down, or the engines are going to go, and he's going to flame out. He's going to have to eject, and they're going to find him, and they're going to cut his head off. Okay, that's you accept that risk as a soldier when you go to war. Nobody likes it. Nobody wants it. I don't want to see it happen, but it's a reality. And until we give them that kind of support, they're not going to have the courage and the guts to go in and do it. That's just the way I see it. I hate to say it, but it's their problem. They need to go fix it. We need to help them.
I agree, and I agree 100% that we're not the air sorties are down to 8 to 10 a day. How are you going to degrade an army of 30,000?
I know.
Well, the argument is, well, we can't find targets. Well, they can't find targets because the restrictions placed on them is worse than Johnson.
Yeah.
Now, this is micromanaged bombing from the White House, by the way, in case you didn't know it.
Before
they blow up a truck.
Approved. Yeah, of course. You have to get presidential approval for every. I mean, this is shades of Vietnam. Have we learned
exactly.
Nothing? Of course, the left has learned nothing.
Well, they
because
forgot.
McNamara, Johnson. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I know it's frustrating. It's just enormously frustrating. And again, I don't see as long as this president is president, and he's going to be the next 2 years. Or less than 2 years, but thankfully it can't come quick enough. But I have to say, I don't know that Hillary Clinton's presidency would be greatly different, given who controls the mindset of the Democrat Party, given the incredibly well-funded far left, and I mean they are well-funded, far left people that control the Democrat Party today. I don't know that Hillary Clinton with half a brain when Obama has none when it comes to this stuff, I don't know that she could fix this problem. Seriously.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to see, Jeff. We'll just have to see. Are you going to stick around and listen to this and then join me at the end, or
you're welcome to stay
or go? Okay, good.
Yeah, how long is the interview again?
About 45 minutes. So it's about,
okay, yeah,
about
8:04. I'll come back in.
Okay.
You got it.
Okay. Now, I'd like to go to an interview I conducted with Matt Lewis of the Daily Caller, the Week. He's a regular columnist there, regular columnist at the Beast, Daily Beast. It's on the controversy over the vaccine issue. And we got into some pretty heavy stuff, and I hope you enjoy it. Here it is. Thanks for joining me tonight on the Rhino Hour of Power. My guest this evening is a frequent guest on the show, Matt Lewis of the Daily Caller, also writes columns in The Week and several other places, I'm sure, that except I haven't gotten around to finding them. Where else can we find your work, Matt, by the way?
I write for the Daily Beast and the London Telegraph as well.
The Daily Beast? Ooh, I'm going to look at your
archives. No, it's great. One of my former colleagues, Will Ron, went over there about, I don't know, 6 months ago. And since then, I think they wanted to increase the conservative presence over there. So I've been writing columns over there a couple a week as a rule.
Wow. Okay. That's great. I don't read the Daily Beast half as much as I should. I just usually skim it for because they have good, interesting angles on their stories. I mean, they've got real rabid Democrats like Tomasky and a few others. But outside of him and one or two others, they really seem to have an interesting and eclectic group of writers there. And I enjoy reading, especially their foreign policy stuff. Okay, well, anyway, let's get on to this. We're talking about the vaccination controversy this evening. And there are so many different angles. Let's start out by admitting our ignorance when it comes to the actual scientific and medical value of vaccinations. We're not experts in that regard. But there's far more to this issue than that. There is the political angle. And then there's an interesting angle that you brought up in your column in the Daily Caller, Matt. It was published, I believe, yesterday, wasn't it?
No, I just sort of banged it out this morning, you know. It's pretty fresh, pretty fresh.
Of anti-vaxxers and, quote, crunch cons, unquote. And basically you make the point that it's not just conservatives who are anti-vaxxers in this controversy. That in fact, a lot of the former hippies, if you will, counterculturalists, are also involved. The whole earth foods people, the environmentalists, people who don't trust science any more than conservatives do. But you think that there's a natural symbiosis between these crunchy cons and mainstream conservatives. I'd like you to explain that a little bit.
Sure. Well, I don't know, about a decade ago or so, Rod Dreher, who was then at National Review, is now at the American Conservative, wrote, I think, a really important book called Crunchy Cons. And then I think that the headline or the subheadline was something about Birkenstock Burkeans or something like that. So that was like the subtitle, I guess. But the book's called Crunchy Cons, and it was an important book, and it was very controversial. He sort of fell out of favor with a lot of conservatives for writing it. But he made some really interesting points about how, when it comes to issues like homeschooling, for example, you have really two types of people who have embraced the homeschooling movement. One group are these Christian conservatives who didn't trust public schools, didn't think they were safe or good, and thought they might indoctrinate their kids into liberalism. So you had these Christian conservatives who were homeschooling. And then you also had sort of these crunchy hippie liberal types, Volvo driving crowd, who started homeschooling. And it didn't end there. There's issues like, say, breastfeeding, where this sort of, traditional conservatives have formed an alliance with the kind of crunchy hippies. And things like going to farmers markets and organic farming. A lot of conservatives nowadays who drive, SUVs to McMansions and stop at McDonald's, they don't go to farmers markets, but kind of like traditionalist conservatives do. And I kind of consider myself to be in that category. I like locally grown food and all that good stuff. I see it as conservative, not as an effete liberal sort of thing.
Yeah.
But the point here is that, as Dreher pointed out in Crunchy Cons, there is this interesting marriage where you have conservatives and hippies really agreeing on what I would consider to be conservative things like homeschooling. And it just occurred to me, though, that this anti-vaccination movement is sort of the dark side of this unlikely pairing.
Yeah, and what defines these two groups, perhaps more than anything else, is a kind of individualism. Now, that's in on the side of the hippies or the counterculturalists, that individualism is informed by communitarianism, which, you know, subsumes the individual's rights and responsibilities at, you know, some level to the good of the whole. On the other hand, of course, there are most conservatives who reject communitarianism and prefer rugged individualism, I guess is the term of the day.
Well, I think there's also, I mean, part and parcel of that, I think, is also a strain of paranoia and conspiracy theories that is prevalent in both ideologies, you know. And think of the hippies, right? So hippies emerged in the 60s and 70s primarily, and they were anti-government there. You know, don't, you know, if you're not worried, you're not paying attention, or whatever the bumper sticker was.
Right.
They didn't trust Nixon. They didn't trust Johnson. They didn't trust what government was telling them. They wanted to check out of society. They wanted to sort of break the dominant paradigm. Don't trust the so-called experts. The generals are telling us they're the military experts. You can't trust them. Well, that same ethos is alive and well in today's Republican Party and today's conservative movement. Don't trust big government. Don't trust big companies. Essentially, we have lost our. I feel like Sting. You know that great Sting song about, you know, if I ever lose my faith in you, you know.
Right.
Where he talks about we lost our trust in the politicians, and that's really happened. I mean, since Watergate, we've had this decline of trust in experts and institutions, and I mean, some of it's like well earned, to be frank with you. I mean,
sure.
I mean, there's a good reason why we don't trust the so-called experts as much as we used to, but I think that it's incredibly damaging, and that it sort of leads to this kind of paranoia that we're seeing today.
Yeah, interesting quote from Rand Paul. As a matter of fact, if I can find it here in that TPM, let's see, I'm sorry, Rand Paul, I just had it. Well, anyway, to paraphrase Rand Paul, he thinks that vaccination should be voluntary, and the reason being that we can't trust the experts. Just because they say they're expert doesn't mean anything. You know, he should know. He's an expert in ophthalmology because he got his own certification, which I find fascinating. Anyway, the idea that this distrust has become so pronounced is largely, in my opinion, the result of the internet, where you can read anything. Anybody can write anything, and it can go viral. And, you know, we see this with these email memes that,
right.
You know, that you know, Obama is a closet Muslim, he's this, he's that, he's a horrible, evil human being, that he's selling the country out to the jihadists because he's a terrorist himself. I mean, this kind of stuff, and people believe it. That's the amazing thing.
Well,
people believe it.
And part and parcel of that, I think, is that, you know, we used to have three TV channels, and there was a downside to that, right? I mean, it was a liberal mainstream media filter, and that was a bad thing. But the good thing about it was there was a consensus. There was, you know, we might have disagreed over opinion, but we didn't disagree over the facts. And there was a general consensus of sort of what was mainstream opinion in America, what was right and wrong. And now we have much more of a sort of moral relativism than we used to have. And I think part of it is there is no consensus. And so it's my truth. It's my reality. And these are really patently unconservative things, by the way. I mean, I see this phenomenon as very unconservative, even though it's being championed by people like Rand Paul, so-called conservatives. But it's very dangerous for a society to not have consensus and to not have people who are willing to submit and sort of subjugate their own personal preference for the larger good of society. And I kind of think that's at play here too.
Yeah, you have an excellent last line in your column. A society without a shared purpose or consensus, without a willing submission to the common good, is a society that ultimately gets more mandates, which is very liberty,
right?
Always requires virtue, which is absolutely true. And
that's why I'm a writer and not, a talker, because I write it so much better than I say it.
You and me both. Having said that, I want to take you back a couple of months or several months where you had a fascinating back and forth with Josh Beryl, who I believe at the time was a Bloomberg political blogger. Josh Beryl, a neoliberal, conservative, whatever you want to call it, center-right, I think is a good description of him. At any rate, you made the point that conservatism is defined by a set of principles, immutable in some respects, but nevertheless, principles. Beryl shot back, "You're wrong. Conservatism is defined by the people who call themselves conservatives." So when you say something like, "This is very unconservative," what you really mean is you think it doesn't live up to conservative principles, and it doesn't. Having said that, the people who define themselves as conservative, fully believe this. So the question is it conservative or is it unconservative?
Well, and first let me say, I'm not doubting this has happened. I actually don't remember the specific debate in question, but I tend to block out things that Josh Beryl tweets and says.
Okay.
I'm joking there. But I think that, to a certain degree, this is semantics. And, I think he has a point. To me, I view it as essentially going back to, I'm sort of in the Yuval Levin camp of this all begins and ends with Edmund Burke versus Thomas Paine.
Yeah.
And it really all begins and ends with the French Revolution. And so to me, the definition of conservatism is really sort of framed around that context. So, a conservative is somebody who cares about tradition and who is not radical, who does not believe that we can make the world over. If you believe in utopian notions that you can, perfect man on earth, then I see that as a very dangerous, unconservative instinct. So I think conservatism is prudent. It harkens to wisdom, to experience things that we've accumulated wisdom and knowledge. And to me, that is the definition of conservative. So when I see like Tea Partiers do things that are radical, that something that Tom Paine might have advocated, I feel comfortable saying that that is patently unconservative. I do think Josh Beryl could make a legitimate argument to say, well, no, conservatism has come to mean something different. And, that's really a semantics debate, I think.
Yeah, that's for sure. Might also add that perhaps the defining characteristic of conservatism or principle, enunciated best probably by Russell Kirk, the conservative philosopher, I guess you could call him, public intellectual, I think is a better description. Kirk thought that prudence was the most important conservative principle, and that, how prudent is it not to get your kids vaccinated? That's radical to me. I mean, aside, my mother, who grew up obviously in the 30s and the
40s, when kids would get polio. And the palpable fear that would run through a community when one kid got polio was real. And it was every sniffle, every little cough, the parent would just panic and wonder if there was, is this polio? Just like with a fever, they'd wonder, is it diphtheria? You know, so vaccinations, more than anything else, gave parents a peace of mind. And she, to the end of her life, thanked God for Jonas Salk, the developer of the first vaccine, which was became commercially available in 1956. I think I remember getting it myself, the first.
Wow.
And I was, maybe 3 years old at the time. But I definitely remember getting the sugar cube, the Sabine vaccine, which we got,
right.
Which they told us to get because the Salk vaccine was only about 70% effective. The Sabine vaccine was about 90% effective. So at any rate, she thanked God to the end of her life for Jonas Salk because she had nightmares of her kids getting polio. And in fact, if you look at pictures from that time, there are whole hospital wards with nothing but these iron lungs. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with an iron lung, it's a great long cylinder that the polio victim would be placed in, and their chest would be constantly compressed because they couldn't breathe. They were paralyzed. That's how you died from polio. You could not breathe. So these iron lungs, and there are pictures of just an entire ward, dozens of them. So, you know, the idea that vaccines are dangerous is not open for debate. It really isn't.
It's such an interesting point because I think that, you know, one of the things that I think conservatives lament is that, you know, liberals who want to say radically change America and who believe that by doing so, that, you know, liberals, I think, tend to believe that they can do anything, all sorts of engineering, and America will be resilient. And I think conservatives believe that the world is much more dangerous and that Western civilization is much more fragile than we think. I think that's a big difference. Conservatives think, wow, we've really been blessed to get something special, and it's fragile. And we have to preserve it. And I think liberals don't really pay that much mind to that. Social engineering comes first. And I think this speaks to that a little bit about we should realize how fragile humanity is and how tenuous this existence is. And I think that people who worry about survival tend to be more conservative. When you have to worry about your kids dying, you tend to be a conservative person. This goes back to Maslow's, you know, hierarchy of needs. When you're worried about your survival, that's different. Once those needs are met, you start thinking about things like self-actualization, which could be like, are women paid the same as men? You know,
these are things you get around. Sure, yeah.
Things you get around to worrying about when you really have nothing to worry about anymore. And I think that the fact that we've gotten around to no longer we're no longer afraid of polio to the degree where we're now potentially subjecting ourselves to it. You know, we're no longer worried about measles to the point where we're now potentially in danger of subjecting ourselves to it. There's a huge, you know, debate to be had. It's fascinating stuff, but I think that it, again, I see it as unconservative. Now, I guess you could argue though that that the notion that government can solve this by a vaccine, it's sort of a fatal conceit, and that's what makes it unconservative. That is a utopian notion that government can fix it. I would just say, I disagree. But you know, if we were going to have an interesting debate, you could probably try to attack my premise from Burkean, you know, from a Burkean argument.
Yeah, and the conflict here, the philosophical conflict, is between a parent's ability to protect their children and the notion that government mandates should not apply to liberty-loving people. This is the philosophical conflict, and we see this I think, with Rand Paul, Chris Christie to some extent, in that they don't necessarily object to vaccinations. I'm sure Rand Paul got his kids vaccinated. But
I think Rand Paul said that he got his kids vaccinated, but he spaced them out because he thought it was bad for them to get, you know, X number of shots back to back to back.
Yeah.
That could impact their immune system. So he got them vaccinated, but he did it. He sort of managed it and spaced it out.
Well, I have no objection with that whatsoever. Just like I have no objection with this new debate, another part of this debate, an offshoot of this debate, which is that some vaccines, tetanus, for example, hepatitis B, for example, aren't necessary for kids. Tetanus, for instance, is not a communicable disease in the sense that it's airborne. Hepatitis B, virtually no children get hepatitis B. So the idea of putting something in your kid with the potential for bad side effects is, I think, an open question and needs to be discussed. But this idea that...
I think that, you know, in fairness to, you know, Christy and Rand Paul, I mean, I would bet that some of what they're trying to say is what you just said. But once you say that, it's easy to characterize you as being anti-vaccine.
Exactly. And that brings us to the political questions of this controversy. The first being, this is a ready-made issue for the Democrats. They've prepared the ground well, as Michael Walsh says in his PJ Media column. They prepared the ground exceptionally well over the last decade or so, highlighting Republicans' anti-science attitudes toward evolution, toward the Big Bang theory, toward just about anything having to do with science and nutrition. I mean, the whole thing is just it sets it up on a tee for them, and they can really whack it. And, you know, it doesn't matter what Rand Paul and Chris Christie actually said or even what they actually meant. It's what the Democrats can do to twist it and make them appear to be ignoramuses.
Well, first, obviously that's entirely true, and I will get to that. But I just want to close out the other side of it, because I do think that Republicans bear a lot of the blame here. Look, there's no doubt that there's a double standard. There's no doubt that the media likes to attack Republicans and make them look bad. But I do think that this speaks to Republicans having sort of put themselves in a bind, in a bad situation here. And I think it's sort of, you know, remember when Mitt Romney said that thing about the 47% or whatever? Like, I think part of the reason he said that was because he said what he thought people wanted to hear. And when I say people, I don't mean the population. I mean the donors.
Right.
Because conservatism in recent years, since Obama, since the rise of the Tea Party, has taken on a very individualistic and libertarian strain. And I think that's what got Romney in trouble. And I think that's part of what's behind this. I think that if you're a conservative who talks about, you know, sort of leans toward things like community and virtue, you are attacked, because what is popular today, you know, compassionate conservatism is out, and what's popular today is this sort of individualism. And I think that leads Republicans and conservatives into this trap where they don't ever want to be, oh, God forbid you ever say something like, yes, I think everybody should have to get these vaccines. That's the last thing in the world you would ever want to be cast as some sort of a collectivist, authoritarian, if you were to say that. I mean, we had this thing, you know, just a story before I hopped on here with you. Tom Tillis was, you know, saying, you know, I don't think people at Starbucks should have to wash their hands. As long as they have to put a sign up saying that that's their policy. Well, like, number
Holy
one,
cow.
Why would you – that's just such a stupid thing to bring up. I mean, whether or not you agree with that philosophically, like being on the side of people going to the bathroom and not washing their hands before making my Frappuccino, is not a good place that you want to, like, voluntarily go.
Absolutely.
So I just think, you know, I don't want to be accused of plugging the book that's not going to be out for a year, because people cannot go and buy it. But I am working on a book, and it's called Too Dumb to Fail. And this is, you know, this is, they keep, every day I see examples proving my thesis correct. Now, to your point, to your question, I mean, yeah, this plays into a lot of narratives that Democrats and liberals want to play into, like the Republican war on science. And as we established at the beginning of this interview, you know, liberals are Jenny McCarthy, plenty of liberals don't want their little, you know, privileged white upper class children, little immune systems to have to endure vaccines. This is, you know, the notion that this causes, you know, diseases or whatever, you know, the Jenny McCarthy thing, it's bogus, and it is pushed by liberals, and yet you can clearly see that this will disproportionately hit Republican candidates.
Oh, yeah. And just to follow up briefly on your comment earlier about conservatives, these are not necessarily these are anti-government conservatives. They really are. You cannot say, I support this federal program. You can't say it without getting somebody to come on and say, oh, you're just a big government liberal, Moran. You know, in fact, you're writing a book. I'm writing a book, too. How about that? Except I'm probably going to have to self-publish it. Confessions of a Conservative Heretic. That's
Well, when it's out, let me know, and I'll get you on my podcast.
Oh, great.
Hash it out.
Yeah.
Turn the tables on you.
Uh-huh. at any rate, it's anti-government. These conservatives, I think most people who call themselves conservative today, would be very much at home, not in 1789 and the Constitution, but 1783 and the Articles of Confederation. These guys, you know, want nothing from Washington.
Yeah. Well, it is funny, because the people who, you know, dress up in tri-cornered hats and, like, worship the Founding Fathers don't really understand that, okay, first of all, the Constitution that they cite all the time was a result of all sorts of compromises. Would not have happened were it not for a bunch of compromises. You know, the fact that our capital is in Washington, D.C., you know, which is a swamp, was the result of a backroom deal between, like, Hamilton and Jefferson and, I think, Madison.
Yes.
I mean, you know, it was, you know, a ton of compromises, and they did not believe that the federal government was strong enough, and it wasn't. It really wasn't. And so, you know, it's very ironic that's sort of who they worship. Yeah, I mean, maybe Patrick Henry would be a good example for them to hold up on high, but
he
not
opposed
the
Constitution.
Sort of,
he and Jefferson.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
yeah. Patrick Henry might be, you know, someone that they could, like, legitimately. And maybe like a Samuel Adams in terms of his radicalism, you know. And but most of the founding fathers, you know, they engaged in compromise. They felt that the government had to be stronger in order to survive. And I think they were right.
Yeah, the historian Paige Smith, who wrote a multi-volume history, the social history of the United States, was excellent, excellent series of books. You should probably spend a year reading them. he said that the Constitution was part of the counter-revolution, where the men of property and the elites actually put their foot down and said, okay, enough of this nonsense. This is just about as Virginia and Maryland were going to go to war over borders. They put their foot down and try to control the mob, as they called the ordinary Americans at that time. The Tea Party folk would do well to read a little history to understand that they are far more comfortable with the Articles of Confederation than the Constitution and what it actually means. But having said that, we'll get back to the vaccinations. So we have the Democrats who are taking advantage of this. We've also got several Republican candidates who have yet to weigh in on this. Are they, do you think, got their finger in the air testing the winds, or do you expect pretty much all Republicans to come down on the side of Rand Paul and Chris Christie and say that, at some point some of these vaccinations should be voluntary?
Well, no, I think that, first of all, Ben Carson, I think, came out, and of course, he is a famous neurosurgeon, and disagreed with Rand Paul and strongly, said that the children should be vaccinated. I don't know where he is on the mandate, but he's making it clear that he's putting distance between him and Rand Paul. Carly Fiorina is with Rand and Christie. I'm told that Rubio will be, if he has not done so already, will be putting out a statement supporting vaccination. So, they say the pioneers take the arrows, and I get the sense that the people who spoke out on this originally were the ones who kind of made the mistake. Now, Rand Paul probably has a philosophical commitment to this. I mean, he was questioning the Civil Rights Act of 1964, so it's not a surprise. But I think Chris Christie was probably caught flat-footed on this. He was in London, and I think he just sort of made a mistake and erred on the side of pandering to the base the way that Mitt Romney did with the 47% comment. So I think that you're going to see that the more time that elapses, you're going to see people come out with more appropriate and prudent statements.
Yeah, and it just seems to me that you've got a ready-made issue here for Democrats, and their presumed nominee also questioned the efficacy of vaccines back in 2008. Because there was a study, I think, in 2007 performed by this British doctor. I sent you that New York Times story on it.
Right.
Who took 12 kids, which is a micro sample, and determined that autism was connected to vaccines. Well, Hillary must have read that because she wanted Congress to have hearings on it. So her hands are not clean in this, which makes this kind of a non-issue headed into the general election. But I think it's going to mix up the Republican race a little bit. You can't be nuanced in this for the simple reason nobody does nuance anymore. I mean,
when you were saying earlier, like tetanus or Hep B, that alone, by trying to make that distinction, that could get you cast in the anti-vaxxer rubric in a headline, and so if you're going to make a nuanced statement like that, you have to couch it appropriately, and you have to be very careful how it's framed and how it's put out. Otherwise, you're going to end up. And then once the narrative is set that you are an anti-vaxxer, good luck changing that narrative. It's essentially set in stone.
Yeah. It would appear that, whoever is going to be moderating those debates, and you really hope it's going to be somebody that is at least halfway fair or halfway conservative. No Wolf Blitzers. What's her name? Candy Wittacrowley. Somebody who is actually going to be neutral and ask neutral questions and not set people up for a fall, as so many of them did during the 2012 debates. Which I thought, right, there are too many, and now we know they're not going to have that many, which is good.
Right. I think you're right. I mean, I think Ryan Priebus has done about as good a job as you could expect an RNC chairman to do in terms of things like trying to get these debates under control and limiting the number of them and who gets to moderate them. And I think the most egregious example, probably wasn't Candy Crowley, it probably was George Stephanopoulos, who you know, really apropos of nothing, you know, essentially started the war on women and set Republicans up, it seemed. It was a non sequitur introduced into one of those early debates in the primaries.
Yeah. Well, you know, just prior to this vaccination controversy, we had another rape controversy with the abortion bill that Speaker Boehner eventually pulled from the floor because Republican women were revolting against the notion that, you know, you had to report the rape in order to get the abortion, as far as the abortion exception to the 20-week abortion ban was concerned. And this, of course, once again, rape comes into play in the Republican Party in ways that make them look anti-women. I'm sorry. You know, they might not be. And I think, again, you're taking stuff out of context or you're putting words in their mouths. But the point being, it doesn't matter what they say. It's the issue and the way the Democrats can frame it that makes the Republicans look like idiots.
But in this case, I think Republicans themselves. I mean, this is essentially a bill that passed 2 years ago. This identical bill that passed. I think a fairly moderate bill. And Republicans are the ones who made a stink about it, and I think turned it into a negative, you know, and the fact that it killed that bill on the eve of the to life mark, the March for Life. So, you know, we may disagree on that one, but I think that, you know, they should have just passed it. And I think that Republicans by, you know, the Renee Elmers and the, you know, the people who helped kill that bill actually sort of were grasping, you know, defeat from the jaws of victory.
I don't know.
I'm seeing here CNN reporter says, Rubio says it should absolutely be mandatory for children to receive some vaccine.
Good for him.
Take that for what it is.
Well, the most important vaccine is the MMR vaccine, the measles, mumps, and rubella, or rubella is not chickenpox. What is rubella? Is whooping cough. Those three are killers. Like 2 or 3 out of every 100, it's 2%, I think, out of every 100 cases end up killing the victim. So, yeah, that is, I think as long as you get those, you're pretty safe. Although the chickenpox is not so much dangerous for the immediate victim, but rather the long-term health effects, sterility, blindness, kidney failure, all these health problems that can arise in children who've had chickenpox. And of course, as we know, watching TV, it's now that what's the rash that you get? What is that called? Not stinger. What is that? Shingles. Shingles is a result of having had chickenpox when you were a kid. I had chickenpox. I had measles. I should have had mumps, but I never did, unless I had a very mild case, because I never got it. But all those diseases were virtually wiped out. Very interesting article I quoted from in my PJ Media Tatler post last night, written by Matt Welch over at Reason.com, where he pointed out a study done, or actually was an overview of infectious diseases. The World Health Organization estimates that more than 1 million people have been saved in the last 50 years as a result of vaccines. In the United States, measles was wiped out. For all intents and purposes, there were no measles in the United States, like 10 cases in 2000. Last year, there were 650. So it's still not a huge problem. But you have to wonder, Matt, you know, what might change a few people's minds on this is if an unvaccinated kid gets measles and dies, and then would it be efficacious for a prosecutor to arrest the parents?
You know, this sounds like a Law and Order episode. I mean, you know how they base it off of, like, true events, you know?
Yeah.
Or at least they did. So, I mean, you could totally see, like, longer taking that exact scenario. And
but this is a religious, that was a religious exemption on that episode, I believe, or a religious belief.
Oh, yeah, they probably did do it.
The American, the science, not Scientologists, the American scientists, something, who don't believe in medicine, don't believe in vaccinations, believe that God...
My whole thing is work as if it all depends on you, pray as if it all depends on God. I mean, I believe in miracles and pray, you know, but you know what? I also believe in vaccines and doctors. You know, and God help, you know, the Lord helps those who help themselves too. I mean, this is my theology here, and you know, I obviously want to be respectful of other people's beliefs, but you know, the problem, what's the line about, you know, your freedom ends or where when your fist hits my nose or whatever, you know, whatever that line is. I mean, the obvious problem here is the herd issue that, you know, you're not only putting your own child in danger, as, you know, as egregious as that may be, you're also... You know, you have, it is a social contract. You have a responsibility to your fellow man as a part of society. And that's something that a lot of today's conservatives really don't like to talk about.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think that's true, and I don't think that makes you a liberal to say it.
Well, one of the things I'm very interested in, Matt, and I'm included in my book, by the way, is this idea of conservatives and community. The idea of community. It's a very nebulous idea, as we all know. But President Obama, I think, framed that issue better than any politician, perhaps it's Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in that his was an all-inclusive community. Anybody can be in our community as long as you do certain things, like obey the government mandates that we come up with and subsume your individual liberty to the greater good. I would call Obama, for instance, a radical communitarian, and I have in the past. But mm-hmm. Republicans have no community. The Republican community is a gated community.
Yeah.
We'll accept anybody except gays and Mexicans. And you know.
That's a good line. That's a great line. I like that. I think you're right. I mean, I think it's an overreaction to Obama. Is what it is. I mean, I think that Obama's wrong and that he goes too far with it, but the response is, you know, I think you could say that because Obama is so radical, that has forced Republicans and conservatives to go to the opposite extreme. Whereas I'd say, no, we should be who we are, where we are, for the things we've always believed in. If we are responding to him, then he is our master. If we are changing who we are to be the exact opposite of Obama, then that means he is really in charge. And so I don't like that, but I think you're totally onto something. And I think that, you know, that it's an overreaction, Obamaism.
So the question, I guess, my last question for you, because we're running out of time here, would the next GOP president, obviously he'd be better than Obama, but would that sense of community, do you think, change and Republicans become more tolerant? Because, you know, I don't care who you are, you have to see this anti-gay, and it's not just anti-illegal immigrant, it's anti-Mexican and Hispanic to a large degree. Would a GOP president be more engender more tolerance in the Republican Party?
Yeah, I think so, actually. I think that, you know, remember when Reagan was president and he was, you know, so conservative compared to other presidents. And I think a couple things happened. One, I think he was able to govern in a very responsible manner in a very prudent manner and, in fact, supported things like amnesty. Simultaneously, I think because Reagan was so conservative, it drove the left crazy. They became radical leftists, and you had, like, you know, them losing, you know, with people like Dukakis, for example, in 88. And then I think Democrats went to Bill Clinton. And then they sort of got their mojo back. And, you know, especially after the 94 Republican Revolution. I mean, I think that, you know, winning covers a multitude of sins, and people who feel powerless and desperate and frustrated tend to be angry and radical, and people who don't feel those ways feel like they have the luxury of being a little more kind and gentle, and that's human nature. So yeah, I think that to some degree Republicans would be a kinder, gentler nation if they had the presidency.
A turn of events that we would devoutly wish would happen. I want to thank my guest this evening, Matt Lewis of the Daily Caller. You can find Matt's stuff over there every day. He writes stuff every day over there, so make sure you get over there at least once a day.
Whether they want it or not, whether
that's
they
right.
like it or not.
We want it, for sure. But anyway, Matt, thanks for joining me, and we'll have you back on again real soon.
All right, thanks for having me.
And that was Matt Lewis of the Daily Caller. What do you think, Jeff?
Well, look, I mean, it was an interesting discussion. And, you know, some of our Republican presidential candidates or wannabes that are out there right now have a disease, and it's called foot-in-mouth disease. you know, the article previously about Tom Tillis, you know, suggesting that, you know, Starbucks workers don't need to wash their hands, or there doesn't need to be a law, and that the free market would take care of that. Well, that would be true if the free market knew that they weren't washing their hands. Now, to be fair, just because the sign in the bathroom says they have to doesn't mean that they actually are. And I would suspect at times that's why we have E. coli outbreaks and other things, because people aren't observing those issues. The outbreaks of measles, I find it interesting that we should be trying to assess as a society, as a public health issue, where this outbreak is coming from. Is it coming from children who've come across the border in you know, illegally and are being allowed to stay
not.
Here under is that true? I mean, I think that is a public health assessment that needs to occur.
Well, you have to have like an inkling of evidence for that to even make a statement like that, and there is absolutely no evidence. In fact, the outbreak originated apparently in Disneyland, where not too many illegal immigrants congregate, okay? So
How do you know that?
Because it costs $50 per person to get in or whatever.
There's lots of
Mexico has a higher rate of inoculations than
Oregon
America,
here
so.
With fancy cars and everything else. You can't tell me that they can't go to Disneyland? Come on, Rick.
Of course
Come
they
on.
Go to Disneyland, but not in the numbers. What are the odds? For every 1,000 white people, there's one illegal Mexican.
But your statement is as illogical as you accuse my statement of being. There is no evidence or proof. Well, you disprove it. You tell me where.
The burden of proof is on you, Jeff.
Tell me where the outbreak of tuberculosis in the inner cities is coming from. I mean, let's go on and on and on with the diseases that have resurfaced, unfortunately, since we have had this enormous expansion born out of the Bush administration.
Jeff, that's nuts.
How do you know that?
This is an argument we should have.
You don't know that.
Well, you're the one that you have the burden of proof, not me.
So then
you make the statement that it's coming from illegal.
Don't call me nuts. That's the rhino coming out in you. See, this is why I'm on the show. The counterpoint to your rhinoism.
Are you saying that because I want evidence that I'm a rhino? Is that what determines what's a rhino and what's a true conservative?
No, because you're lambasting me, saying it's insane to blame this on illegal aliens.
Did the word insane leave my lips? The word insane did not leave my lips.
Well, all right.
Okay.
All I'm
asking for is a smidgen of proof, and the burden of proof is on you.
Okay, so let's engage in the investigation because the seriousness of the charges must lead to an investigation.
Well,
do you remember that?
See, here's the problem. If the CDC comes up and they trace this disease to a white kid, unvaccinated kid about 9 years old.
No problem.
Really? Because half the people making your argument will say, well, it's the CDC.
I have no problem admitting to you that I was suggesting an improper direction of research and investigation. I think they all ought to be introduced. I just think it's very interesting that since we've had them from the Bush years of opening the border, and yes, Bush did it, folks. From the Bush years of opening the border to illegals flooding across, and I was there. I've been there. I'm telling you, the highest probability of people coming into this country with diseases are people who are coming here without vaccinations, who are coming here across the border without having a passport and anything else that indicates that they have followed the proper rules to come into this country. That's the highest probability. That is highly logical. I'd like to see you dispute that.
Mexico has a much higher rate of inoculation against measles, mumps, and rubella than the United States. How's that?
I don't believe that.
How's that for proof?
I don't believe that. Okay. I don't believe that. Show me the proof. Show me the proof.
That's the World Health Organization. Go to the World Health Organization
website.
All right.
So what about the Guatemalans and the Hondurans who come up through Mexico? What about them? The Nicaraguans? The Panamanians?
I don't know about the rates there, but the point being, you know, you have to have proof if you're going to make a charge like that. You have to have proof.
I'm not making.
I'm hungry.
A charge.
I want to eat. I have to eat.
It's obvious that you need to.
In the Midwest.
Your blood sugar levels are extraordinarily low.
And I'm getting cranky.
You're being illogical. Yes, you are getting cranky, that is for sure.
No oxygen to the brain, that's the problem. Okay.
Well,
anyway,
have a glass
Jeff,
of wine
as usual, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. Very good discussion about
And I look forward to it again. I truly do, as always, my friend, and I appreciate you being diligent in asking me to come on when it seemed like it was impossible for weeks on end. But we will always move heaven and earth to be on the Rhino Hour of Power.
And with that, I'll say thank you, Jeff. See you again soon, and join us again next week, same time, same place. Bye-bye.